Thank you, Jeremy, for sharing that. You reminded me of the words of our Nigerian teaching pastor at our community in Chicago, who last Sunday was commenting on American Christianity in light of church shopping. He said, "We've moved from hearts of commitment to hearts of consuming, and sometimes we tip based on how we feel." And that was his comment on American Christianity. You know, it's interesting. A pastor once said, "Man, my ministry would be so much easier if it wasn't for my people." You don't really have a ministry without people. And I think maybe some of us in business sometimes as well feel that way. Man, it would be so much easier if it wasn't for my people. But then we also wouldn't have our business. Somebody came to me last night, by the way, and Jeremy, you're going to like this, and said, "Are you going to talk about firing people?" And I said, "In fact, I am." So come back this afternoon, make sure you're here, Jeremy, and I'm going to talk about firing people. So we're going to have some fun with that this afternoon. If you want the digital notes, you can go ahead and download those. Otherwise, they're in your folder. We're going to continue on from where we left off last night, but I want to just give you a little bit of an introduction to myself, a little bit more about me, where I come from. I was a school teacher in Western Canada, grew up in Eastern Canada. And that started to take me down a trajectory in my life that I hadn't planned on. I was planning to go into concrete work, as I shared last night. I'm a concrete guy, but I ended up being a teacher. And then I went on to found and direct a nonprofit for 10 years in Southeast Asia. It's where I sharpened my teeth on leadership, learned how to work with people, and developed a lot of soft skills. And eventually went on to get a degree at Asbury Seminary, master's in leadership, and since then I've been working a lot in both the nonprofit and the business world, primarily in soft skills. And I've got a lot of different brochures up here on my table if you're interested in all the different things that I speak on. I'm talking about employee engagement here at this event, but I also speak on serving leadership, communication skills, lean, mean, teaming machines, which is a teamwork one-day seminar workshop. Generations at Work is some of my newer stuff on working with Gen X, Gen Y, the millennials, now Gen Z. I'm a Gen X, so I spend most of my energy on the Ys and the Zs in that presentation. And then my latest stuff is winning at customer service. How do we win at customer service? So number of things that I speak on in the business world. I'm also in the church world. In fact, Lynn, where are you at? Right over here. Okay. I'm going to be working at Lynn's. We were talking last night. Should we be addressing more of the business world or the church world when I come? And you know, they're integrated, aren't they? We really ought to be in both worlds. And so thank you, Jeremy, for reminding us of that this morning. My commitment, of course, is to give you my best shot. When I win and you win and we all win, that's what matters to me. So I'm here to help assist you, help you start thinking about this subject, which I'm sure you've already done a lot of processing on as well. And at the end of this presentation, we're going to give you more time to go back into your brainstorming groups, because that's where I believe the real work happens, where we take some of the ideas or maybe some of the thoughts that I spawned, and you take it to the next level and say, now, how is this going to work in my situation, my organization, my company, my church, my community? So we'll give you that chance again at the end. Well, last night we showed you this graphic about what leadership training is not. We said that everyone is unique. Everyone must be led and managed differently. And there are many things that we all have in common. When people show up at work, they all want to have a paycheck. We all know that. They all want to leave work on time, and they all want to take off on the weekend. There are some things that are very common to all people, but we are all very unique and need to be led and managed differently. So I want to just talk a little bit about what makes each person tick. What is it that the inner motivations, what are we comprised of? And I got this from Michael Hyatt a number of years ago. Who am I? And he uses three circles which overlap in the middle to create one spot where we should spend most of our time. We can't spend all of our time, but most of our time should be spent in that one area. And if we can get our people working in that sweet spot, we will have highly motivated and engaged people. The first circle that Hyatt talks about is the circle of proficiency. What are our gifts, abilities, and strengths? Now, We all have a lot of gifts, abilities, and strengths. Where I grew up in Southern Ontario, my dad was a farmer. He ran a construction company. I got good in some of those skills connected to farming and concrete work. I was my dad's floor finisher. I ran a powered trawl. And I was also pretty good at hockey. I knew I was never going to make it to the NHL. I was way too small, but I was fast. I always knew how to get away from the big guys, so I didn't get crushed. But I loved hockey. There is a number of things that I could, looking back, say, yeah, you know, those were areas that were in my strength zone or my gifts and abilities. So what is it that people are good at? We all have different abilities. And some of us have not even discovered some of our, what our strengths are. For example, my grade 6 vacation Bible school teacher called something out in me that I never saw. And to this day, Gene Erb is one of my greatest one of my greatest heroes. And when I, you know, where I grew up, I sang in a choir. In fact, I was talking to somebody this morning, way back when the crust of the earth was still forming, I sang with the Hartville Singers as part of the Bethel Lake Choir that came down and did this joint venture, David the Shepherd Boy. Any of you remember that? If you're from Hartville, you may remember David the Shepherd Boy. I was a baritone, which means barely a tone. I speak today because I don't do very well at singing, and I was in a choir with Jean, and she was the orator of the choir, and she just had all kinds of ethos and pathos and just awe in her voice, and she could really bring it. She could reduce the crowd to tears. She knew I was a baritone. Baritones, by the way, they don't have a voice high enough for tenor or low enough for bass. So you get stuck there in the middle, and they give you about 5 notes every 4 songs. Any baritones in the room? You're barely a tone, okay? And so she went to the director in Ontario, said, I think Luke ought to have one of my speaking parts. And she saw something in me I didn't see. And so as a result of Gene, I ventured out. Had an oratory part in the choir. A few years later down the road, I moved out to Alberta, Canada, became a school teacher at age 19. Now, I need to share with you that I really went out west to join a hockey team and ski the Rockies. Now, that was back before snowboarding was cool. But I really went out there for other motives, and I'll teach school on the side because that's my ticket. But what was amazing to me is a year in, I discovered I love to teach. I love to see the lights come on. I actually told an audience of mine over there in Holmes County a couple years ago, I said, I can teach you the metric system in 5 minutes. And some of them took me up on it. After the event, we went back to the whiteboard, and I taught a metric in 5 minutes. Now, some of you are going, Luke, I don't care about the metric system. I'm an American. Well, you know, we ought to catch up with the rest of the world someday. I'll just say that as a Canadian here. And I see a few people clapping hands. Yeah, the metric system, folks, makes sense. It really does. I love to see the lights come on. And I discovered a strength that I didn't know I had as I began to teach. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, what are your strengths or where are your strengths at? And you might say, well, I'm at a 5 on this one. I'm at a 6 on this one. I'm really at a 3 at this one. The experts out there will tell us not to focus on our weaknesses, but actually to develop our strengths. And I agree with that, but I will just say that some of us have a strength that right now is at a 4, but you have the potential to take it up to an 8 or a 9, maybe even a 10. And sometimes we have to go into discovery mode and figure out what those strengths are. Sometimes the people that are working for us are in a wrong position. They've actually got a strength in another area, and the reason they're demotivated, they don't even know that they're demotivated, is because they're not actually working in an area that brings them energy, okay? And Marcus Buckingham has done a lot of great work on the strengths movement. Highly recommend his work. The second area is that of your passion area. What are you passionate about? What really interests you? What makes you lose all sense of time? What do you get really passionate about? And it could be a number of things that fascinate you, that are very interesting to you. And then the third one is what Hyatt calls profitability. And he says that's the one that pays the bills. We all have to be involved in something that makes profit. Discover that area that you can actually make some profit at what you love to do, what you're good at doing, and that's where you find your sweet spot, where all three converge. Now, folks, we can't live in that sweet spot all of the time, but we can live in it most of the time. And this is how I qualify my sweet spot today. It is the area that I will bring God the greatest glory and I will experience the greatest joy. And I want to experience joy. I want to live a fulfilled life. I want to live a life that honestly brings 100%, delivers 100-fold. I want to live in an area that I'm fully alive. I think it was the early church father Irenaeus who said, "The glory of God is man fully alive." We want to help our people be fully alive. So helping them find their sweet spot, what they're good at doing, what they're passionate about, and what they get, where they can be paid to live in that area is their sweet spot. Helping them find that can be a powerful motivator for them at your job site. Now, I've put together a purpose statement template to help people with this. It is a free resource. I'm gonna show you where you can get that online. Some people call it a mission statement. I call it a purpose statement. This is simply a template. It helps you figure out what your core strengths are. Helps you write those down, what your mission, your values. I have four short videos that go along with that. So again, that is there's the short code. If you put that into your browser or click the QR code, you can go directly to that online resource. Now, the only thing I get from you, my wife always says, "Luke, you need to be upfront about this." And so I'm being upfront about this. I get your email address, all right? And I add you to my blog, which I blog 3 times a week. Each of my blogs can be read in a minute or less. I blog on leadership, on life. And there's this lovely little thing at the bottom of each of my emails called unsubscribe, and I will never know it, all right? So you can just click that if you get too much email like I do, and I will never be offended. So the purpose statement is to help your people figure out their mission, their purpose in life. And I help you write down things like your core convictions, your personal creed, your values, your strengths, your goals, a not-to-do list. How many of you have a not-to-do list? Okay, good is the enemy of best. How many of you know that? We can be involved in so many good things, but we need to cut out those good things so we focus on what is best. Your hopes and your dreams and even your legacy. And when I worked on my personal purpose statement years ago, folks, it became one of the most energizing, most engaging activities I'd ever done. And it keeps me aligned even to this day. My mission statement isn't just on the wall. It rides around with me in my bag. And I pull it out from time to time. I tweak it. I change it. My values don't necessarily change. My core convictions don't necessarily change. But there are aspects that change from time to time. I still refer to it on a regular basis. And it helps me stay aligned to my area of calling, that sweet spot that I talked about. And then lastly, I give you an opportunity in that to write your obituary. I know that sounds awfully morbid, but one of the best ways to write your purpose statement is to write your obituary. I learned this from Ken Blanchard a number of years ago. And what do you want people to say about you after you're gone? Why not start preparing for that today? And the story I'd like to share with you just to wrap this part up of my talk this morning is a story of a guy named Alfred. Now, Alfred lived many years ago, as the black and white rendition there would suggest. And Alfred had an interesting story. And he changed his story midstream. What happened is his brother passed away, and the morning that the newspaper came out with his brother's obituary, he fixed his coffee, went out to the front door, grabbed the paper, came back inside to read what the paper had to say, what the obituary had to say about his brother, and to his horror and shock, as he opened up the front page, he realized they got the wrong guy. They had his obituary, and the headline screamed his obituary, and it was simply this: "The merchant of death is dead." You see, Alfred was the guy that had invented dynamite. And he realized that he would be remembered for death and destruction for the rest of eternity. And so he said, "I have got to change my obituary. I have got to rewrite my story, how I will be remembered for. And today, you and I know him for something else." Most of us don't know the inventor of dynamite, but we do know Alfred Nobel, who started the Nobel Peace Prize. he rewrote his obituary, rewrote his life legacy. And every one of us, we can help our people, we can rewrite ours. I've rewritten my obituary. I carry it around on my phone. I read it from time to time. And your obituary, by the way, doesn't necessarily have to be true. I know when I heard Ken's, he said, he was a lean, mean, 185-pound golfing machine. He said, I'm not that, but by the time I die, I hope I will be. So you can write some things in there that you are aspiring to be. But writing your obituary is a great way to write your personal mission statement. All right, I'd like to move now into this issue of profitability, inspiring, motivating, engaging our people around the idea of profit, of pay. Do we motivate people based on money? Is that the key motivator? And the reality is that motivation works differently for different people. It also works differently depending at where you're at in your task or your job. Those with simpler tasks, less cognitive skills required, those whose jobs are entry level, money will always be the number one motivator for them. All right? Most people start out with money as the greatest motivator for them to work. But as the job involves greater creativity, more decision making, greater complexity, more cognitive skills required, you need to level up your pay scale to include more than just bonuses and money. For jobs and tasks that involve mostly mechanical skills, those extrinsic or outside motivators like money or bonuses or gift cards or whatever, they work well, all right? The extrinsic works well when the task is very simple. But as people go up, as people begin to make more decisions, become more creative, the pay actually reduces their performance, which is an interesting statement. Larger rewards actually lead to poor performance. And as I said last night, obviously that means we got to go back and, you know, slice a lot of people's paychecks, right? That might be good news for you if you're a business owner this morning. I think when you return to the office and suggest that, you'll probably not be met with cheers. So that's not what I'm obviously suggesting. We do need to set the right pay scale. We do need to set an appropriate, reasonable, adequate salary. But after that, we need to address the intrinsic motivators. We need to focus on those intrinsic, inside, internal motivators for better performance. I highly recommend this TED Talk, and I don't know if any of you read TED Talks. They're great for the business community. They're usually only 18 minutes long. This one is especially good. This morning when I checked, it has actually over 25 million views now. It's one of the popular ones out there by Dan Pink. Only takes you 18 minutes. And he says this: there is a mismatch between what science says and what business does. We in business do what the science says is otherwise. Regarding today's theory of motivation, intrinsic motivators are actually better than extrinsic. And yet most of us reward with extrinsic, with the external, the bonuses, the more money, the gift cards or whatever. And it kind of goes back to this old concept. I think it was George Kelly who called it the great jackass theory of motivation. It's a great jackass theory of human motivation. But people are not donkeys, right? And, just sweeten the carrot or sharpen the stick, you know, rewards and punishments. People don't work this way. Even though they did that a lot in the Industrial Revolution, this is not the greatest way to motivate and engage your people today. Now, one way that they tested this idea of the extrinsic versus the intrinsic was what has become known as Dunker's Candle Problem. And Dan Pink shares this in his talk. I'm going to go over this very, very briefly, but this is a little bit of the science behind motivation. Scientist Sam Glucksberg, that was the guy's name. If you want to look him up, Sam Glucksberg, he showed the power of incentives by using it in an experiment. He gathered his participants together and he said, I'm going to time you how quickly you can solve this problem. Now, he hasn't told them what the problem is. I'm going to show it to you in a minute. But I'm going to time you on how quickly you can solve it. To the one group, he said, so he had two groups of people. I'm going to time you to establish the norms or the averages. What does it normally take for a group to solve this kind of problem? To the second group, he said, I'm going to give you guys a reward. That if you are in the top 25% of the fastest times of solving this problem, then you get $5. If you're the fastest of everyone today in all the groups, not just the top 25%, you're going to get a gift of $20. Now, adjusted for inflation, because this was many, many years ago, it was actually a decent sum of money for the people in the room on who they did these tests. It was a very nice motivator. Now, here's the test, the Dunker's candle problem. Using some tacks, a candle, and some matches, fix and light a candle on a wall in such a way that the candle wax won't drip onto the table below. Simple problem. All right, take some tacks, a candle, and some matches, and attach the candle in such a way that it will not drip onto the table below. Anybody want to venture up a solution? Use the box. Okay, very good. And that's the answer. Have you seen this before? Move the table. Ah, someone's thinking outside the box. Pun intended. All right. So that is actually the solution. Use the box. Now, the question arises, which group actually solved it quicker? I didn't take the time to set you up into groups. But here's the science behind this. It was actually the incentivized group that took, on average, you guys are really, really smart, because it took them, on average, 3.5 minutes longer. So I must have posited the question wrong. And you would say, well, wait a second. The incentivized group, the group that was given $25 or $20 or $5 bonus if they were in the top 25%, we're Americans. Like we really believe in free markets, and that's not how it's supposed to work. But that's what they discovered. On average, it took 3.5 minutes longer if they threw incentives at the group. But when the tacks were taken out of the box, now this is the interesting part. When the tacks were removed from the box, they noticed that the times were basically equal. In other words, when people did not see the box as a receptacle for the tacks, okay, but it was now actually part of the solution, The problem got solved by both groups pretty well at the same time, more or less equal at the same time. They simplified the path to the solution. They took the complexity out of the problem. Extrinsic motivators worked fine. Otherwise, the intrinsic motivators were actually better, and those groups solved the problem much, much quicker. Dr. Bernd Erlenbusch at the London School of Economics has gone so far to say that we find that financial incentives can result in a negative impact on overall performance. We throw too much money at it, we can actually have a negative impact on people's performance. So we need to be careful if only our only motivator is upping the paycheck. And back to Maslow's hierarchy that we talked about last night, those two bottom basic human needs, physiological and safety, that's where the paycheck really, really meets the need. And beyond that, we have to go up in meeting needs and not just throwing money at the situation. According to Dan Pink, we need a new operating system for business. He says one that is made up of three elements, and this speaks to intrinsic motivators. The first one is autonomy. Everybody wants to run their own or direct their own lives. They have this urge within to have autonomy, to be self-directed. And he says we need to have an operating system for our business which builds autonomy into it, where people can be self-directed. The second one, he says, is mastery, the desire to get better and better at something that really matters. People want to master something. They want to become competent in something. And so give them the chance to operate under mastery. And then the third one is purpose, the yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves. The yearning to do something in the service of something larger than ourselves. I want to just process autonomy a little bit more with you, a little deeper. Self-direction works a lot better than management. A lot better than management. When we begin to self-direct our lives, and I'm going to go back to my story just briefly. When I moved out west and began to teach school, I was age 19 at the time, and I was on my own. There was something that was released in me. And maybe you can think back when you took your first job and you were away from home. But back there for me, that idea of learning a new skill, stepping out on my own was very, very powerful for me. And later, as I got an opportunity to found and direct an organization, this too released something within me. And I believe that all of us here, made in the image of God, have this creative aspect to us. Jeremy touched on this morning. We were made to build stuff, right? We were made to be directed in ways of creativity. We were put in a garden to be fruitful, to multiply, to build stuff. And Adam and Eve, as you remember, were their first creative act was to name the animals. Some would say that was only Adam. I would argue that God brought Eve into the mix simply because Adam probably ran out of ideas. Any of you run out of ideas here? He started out really well with rhinoceros and hippopotamus and all these wonderful names. And by day 4 or 5, he was probably down to one-liners like cat, dog, pig. That's why he got saddled with those names. And according to one person I heard, by day 6 or 7, it was like whatever they're doing, like fly, you know. And so you need to bring a helper alongside you, Mr. Adam. And so Eve gets introduced. And of course, we're back to crocodile and kangaroo. And so you can be very thankful that God brought someone else along to help him in his self-direction. But we were made to create. We were made to build stuff. And we were made to be outward focused. And one of the things that I love to do when I talk about serving leadership is talk about the theology of serving leadership. And I don't know if you've ever thought of this before or not. I always have some really weird questions running around in my head. I'd say about 5 years ago, I was asking the question from Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve sinned, why nakedness? Why in that moment of sin they recognized that they were naked? Most of us, when we're naked, we're pretty self-aware. And, but for Adam and Eve, it was like all at once the lights came on. So I asked my really smart, theologically driven brother this question. He gave me the standard, you know, shame. And I asked my good friend Stan, and he said, shame. And I said, yeah, but, you know, I had 3 kids. And I don't know if you remember your children when they were really, really young. We had 2 of ours born in Thailand. I remember when we'd get them out of the bathtub, they would run through the house stark naked and had no shame. Anybody have normal kids like mine? All right. And I want to tell you, they were sinners. Cute little sinners nonetheless, but they were sinners. And they were very self-focused, inward driven, right? And life was about them, right? They grabbed the rails of their playpen, and I'm the blessed controller around here. You're going to feed me. You're going to listen to me. You're going to, you know, everything was about them. And you know, I just didn't really get this thing about nakedness and shame. Didn't make a lot of sense to me. So my mentor helped me out with this, Dr. Dennis Kinlaw. This all goes back to some amazing talks I had with him. A.W. Tozer once said, the most important thing about us is what comes into our minds when we think about God, okay? And Kinlaw helped me process the whole idea of the others-oriented nature of God. God in the beginning, we even see where he says, let us make man in our image. Whether that's a reference to the Trinity or not, some would believe it is. But there's a Father, a Son, and a Holy Spirit. When we see Jesus come on the scene, the Father is all about the Son. The Son is all about doing the Father's will. And when the Spirit comes, he will speak about the Son. And so this others-oriented nature of the Trinity is an image that we've been made into. And this was so key for me to understand serving leadership, because we were made to serve. We were made for the other. We were not made for ourselves. And Augustine, when he came along, the great theologian in the middle of Christendom, he said that sin is when we are curved in on ourselves. He used this Latin term in curvatus in se. And he says we are curved in on ourselves, which is exactly what Adam and Eve did before they discovered that they were naked. And so when Kinlaw began to break this down for me, I began to realize something. You know, life just works a whole lot better when we are outward focused, when we are directed on something outside of ourselves. Would you all agree with that? In a marriage, when I'm all about my spouse and she's all about me and we're all about the children and the children are all about us, it just makes for a better family. In my company, in my business, in my organization, when I am all about my people and my people are all about honoring the leadership and we're all about the mission and the purpose and what we're about, things just go a lot better. Would you all agree with that? when we are outward focused. And so in that moment, when we got off of our God likeness and we became curved in on ourselves, that's what Augustine calls sin, original sin. I used to think sin was rape, murder, theft, all those things. But those are actually the fruits of sin. Sin is when you and I are curved in on ourselves, and what happened is the snake. And by the way, don't ever listen to a snake. Things don't go well, okay? And the snake says, God is holding out on you. He knows that the day that you eat this fruit, and by the way, they had all the trees in the garden. Can you imagine them bypassing all these trees to get to this one over here? And the snake says he's holding out on you, and he knows that you can be like him. And the crazy thing is, they already were like God. They already were focused outside of themselves. They already were in a creative process in the garden. They were naming animals. They were being fruitful. They were multiplying. They were tending the crops. They were working. Work is a good thing, right? Work is what we were made for. And in that moment, Satan twists the image of God. And I think this is what happens a lot of times in our world today. Voltaire, the famous atheist, actually said this, that God made us in his image and we remake him in our broken image. All right? So we reframe back on God our broken concept. We think God is hung up on himself. He's a megalomaniac up in the heavens. He wants glory. God wants all this stuff for him. But the reality is the very act of creating the earth, the very act of creating you and me was an act of others' orientation, an act of grace and mercy, of creating something. It was generosity. And we were made in this image. But when you and I became focused in on ourselves, we noticed something. And this is where nakedness comes in, folks. Adam and Eve, in the moment they took that fruit, that says their eyes were opened, and I believe that they were like, and again, you know, maybe Adam and Eve pinched themselves and said, yeah, I exist. But up until that moment, they had no self-awareness, no self-concept, no self-belief, no self-ad nauseum. There was no self-help books back then, okay? And it was not about them. They were completely fixated outside of themselves. But in that moment when they took the fruit, for the first time, they said, oh, I am. And then they looked at who they really were and said, I am not. Because there really is only one great I am. Man is contingent on God. And we have absolutely nothing within ourselves apart from the one who gives us life, ideas, energy, light, and we could fill in a lot of blanks. We were made, folks, to be outward focused. And I'm just going to wrap this little segment up briefly with one last thing. And Kinlaw took me to Romans 1, verse 18. He said that the wrath of God is revealed against all godlessness and unrighteousness. And in my books, those are the same word, all right? I have a, you know, an English mind, and I don't think in terms of Greek, but apparently it's two different Greek words, asebia and adikia, and the one means not worthship, and the other one means not rightness. And what happens is that you and I, when we stop attributing worth and value outside of ourselves, we stop worshiping, all right? Every employee, every spouse, every child, every person we relate to, when we put worth and value, in a sense, worship those people, we are valuing them. We are focused outside of ourselves. That is being godly, actually. And Kinlaw said, when we stop worshiping, we start doing unright things. Unrightness, adikia, always comes after asebia. We stop worshiping, we start doing crazy stuff. And that's exactly what happened in the garden. Adam and Eve stopped worshiping that which was truly worthy, and then they started doing crazy things. And we know Pandora's box was opened. Hell was unleashed on the world. Relationships broke down. Their two sons, one got murdered. And this happens in our work world. This happens in our leadership, in our relationships. When we are curved in curvatus in se, the Latin term there from Augustine, when we're curved in ourselves, then things just start to break down. When we are curved out, when we are autonomously self-directed, but not for ourselves, but for something greater than ourselves, then things work better. I think I'm going to move on from that. That was a powerful theological lesson for me on understanding serving leadership, that we were made to serve. We were made to be self-directed outside of ourselves. This is what makes people tick, what makes people work. I would just say in practical terms, one way to do this, and when we go to our brainstorming groups here in a few minutes, we need to think about how can we help our people have autonomy over time, over task, over technique, and over their team. If you want to write those four words down, how can we help them over the when they will complete the task, the time, how will they manage their time? This is context driven, right? If you're in a factory in a certain things have to be done on time, but in some of our contexts, we can give people autonomy over time. Task, the what tasks need to be completed, giving them autonomy on that. The technique, which is the how are things completed? Is it my way or the highway, right? Sometimes we think our way is the best way, and it might be, but sometimes people have better ideas. I remember a young man by the name of Brian joining us on staff in Asia. I had developed, probably spent up to 200 hours with Excel spreadsheets, developing an accounting system for our people that worked with multiple currencies. And I had gotten this base spreadsheet from the Southern Baptists, stole from them, they gave it to me, and then developed it for our people, for our organization, did all the neat little tweaks and stuff. And it would take me like 3 hours to teach our staff this Excel spreadsheet. And I thought it was pretty cool. And along comes Brian, and he says, "Luke, Microsoft Money does that a whole lot easier, and it's only like $25. And I'm like, "Brian, go home. Like, I just put a lot of time and energy into this super cool spreadsheet." But I'm so glad I listened to him on the what and the technique on the how, and all our staff were very grateful that I listened to Brian in that case. So let them fulfill their quota their way. And again, context-driven. The when, the where, the how is up to them. And there's a balance on all that and how it's largely driven by your context. But I think we can have those conversations more than we have them. And lest you think this won't work in your environment, I want to close with a case study involving some janitors at a factory. This comes from Stephen Covey's book, The Eighth Habit. Fascinating story of a foreman who showed up at one of his conferences and said, "Mr. Covey, I hear what you're saying on autonomy, on self-direction. I hear what you're saying but Mr. Covey, that will not work with my janitors." Now, he was at a large factory. They had a whole team of janitors that would keep the complex clean. And he just said, "You don't understand. They're on the lowest rung of the work ladder. It's a nameless, faceless job. There's low pay. There's high turnover because all you got to do is empty the trash and mop the floors. And this idea of self-direction will not work with my janitors." So Cubby said, well, just tell me a little bit about your janitorial work. What do they actually do?" He said, "Well, there's really three phases. There's the planning phase, you know, where I plan who will work when and where, and I will go through all the details of the planning and setting up schedules, and then of course there's the doing phase. You know, they do the mopping and the cleaning and the toilets and all that stuff. And then the final piece is the evaluating. I go around and I evaluate whether or not they did a great job." So he said there's really three phases to a janitorial job. And typically I make all the decisions. I control all the outcomes because I'm in charge. I'm the foreman after all. And Covey said, "Well, what if we switch things up a little bit? What if we had them join you in the planning phase? What if they actually were able to join you in choosing what kind of waxes to use, what kind of machinery to use? You know, maybe the mops that have the ergonomical handles so it saves their back. You always buy the cheap mop handles, right? The straight ones. But what if they were able to choose the waxes that last a lot longer? What if they were able to make some of the decisions? They're the ones closest to the job. Why are you making that decision? And so why don't you involve them? And then scheduling. What if, John has a doctor's appointment and he would like, Maggie to fill in for him because, you know, his wife's off at her job. Dropping one of the children off at the doctor's. And so he really needs Maggie to fill in for him. Why don't you let them rearrange their schedules without you being involved? Because they always hate to come to the boss, right? And you're probably not too happy when you have to rearrange things. So why not let them help out with the planning phase? And then the doing, I mean, obviously they're going to do the sweeping, scrubbing, waxing, removing garbage, but what about the evaluation stage? What if you allowed them to evaluate themselves? What if they were able to self-evaluate the factory? And by the way, I don't know if you've ever been demotivated as a cleaning person. After I got married, I worked for my wife. I went to her job place. She was cleaning homes at the time, and I'm just gonna say, my hat is off to anybody who cleans. That's like one of the hardest jobs in the world. And what's demotivating is when you clean something that's already clean. Anybody know what I'm talking about? But you have to do it, right? But it's already clean. And it's just very de-energizing, demotivating to clean something that's already clean. So, you know, in this big factory, for example, you got the warehouse back there where hardly anybody ever goes. The forklifts drive back in that area. The bathrooms back there maybe get used once a week, right, by the forklift driver. And what if you would let them do the planning, the doing, and the evaluating based on how much traffic, right? And they could actually save some time because they don't have to clean those bathrooms quite as much. But you as a foreman looking, you know, from the top down, you're always demanding that everything gets done equally. What if they were involved in all three phases? Well, when the foreman actually did this, went back to his factory, tapped into the body, the heart, and the mind, the results were actually surprising. And he reported back to Covey later. He says, you know what? Quality went up in our work. Job turnover actually went down. Now, that's pretty cool, right, at a janitorial position. And he said job satisfaction increased significantly. Those were the foreman's words back to Mr. Covey. And so there are ways that we can apply this in our context. I want to give us a chance to do that here in our last 15. Actually, I think we'll maybe take 10 minutes to do this. We'll get back into our groups. And we're basically going to be looking at three questions that I want you to talk about in your groups. So again, if you want to go back to the same group, you can. If you want to find three or four new people today, go ahead and do that. But let's get into our groups, and then let's keep it quiet so that I can go over the three questions, and then we'll go into brainstorming here at the end of this session. One company that I worked with would have a suggestion box, and if the suggestion was a good one and they actually used it, they would actually give that person a gift card or some kind of a reward, a bonus, if that idea actually worked. Where the greatest contribution they could make to your company? What did they believe is their greatest contribution? Find that out. And again, it's just I call this a knowledge worker info sheet. Kind of for you to put together some ideas on your employees. The last one on that sheet is a desire for more training. Maybe they would like to do some cross training. Again, this is especially good with the younger generation. Also, up here at my resource table, I do have a free CD. It's a worship CD put out by Lead Like Jesus. I used to be a master trainer with them. And on here is the Today song that we especially feature in our leadership material. So if you want a free worship CD, I know these are going out. We're all doing the MP3 thing or something, Spotify these days. But these are all free. If you would like to help yourself, I've got plenty of those with me. A few books that I've got along with me specifically for this material. This is a Ken Blanchard book. One thing I love about Blanchard is he writes in story form. And this one's called Gung Ho, Turn on the People in Any Organization. Gung Ho by Ken Blanchard. I've got a couple copies with me. My hardcovers are all 15. My softcovers are all 10. And $10, that is. And I'll, by the way, I can do credit cards, checks. I even trade goats if you want to trade a goat. My wife says, don't you dare bring a goat home. But I no one's brought a goat to me yet. So Whale Done is another one that Blanchard has written. He actually worked with the people at SeaWorld down there in Florida and discovered what motivates whales, okay? And one of the best management advice that I ever heard from Blanchard was catch your people doing the right thing. And how many of us catch our people doing the wrong thing, right? And especially our children. This was some of the best parenting advice that I ever got was Whale Done. Catch your people doing the right thing. So Whale Done, The Power of Positive Relationships. And then this last one, because we're in political season, all right? And I'm pretty passionate about listening. This is an area that I have had to work especially hard on, as I shared last night. And one of my biggest concerns in America is not, you know, I've got my opinions and my ideas, but it's the fact that we are not listening to each other. We're like ships passing each other in the night. And we simply demonize the other side, and we don't listen to one thing they have to say. And our country is getting further and further polarized because we are unable to listen. And I think this is for marriage, for business, but especially in light of our political season. I'm carrying a book called I Think You're Wrong, But I'm Listening. All right? And it's from a faith-based perspective, and would like to highly recommend this in light of our political season. In fact, you know what? I'm going to just sell this one for 10 bucks, okay? My other hardcovers are 15, but this one's for 10. If you want to pick that one up and maybe change the future a little bit of our country. Lastly, I wanted to share with you very briefly, I have a coaching program on serving leadership. I come into a company, and I work in changing the operating software to a serving leadership culture. And Koblenz, Jason, you're back in the back. I worked with Koblenz Chocolate. Some of his guys are here as well. If you would like to find out a direct review, I never talked to them about this. I never asked them to put a good word in for me. I might not get a good word from them. But I did this program with their people last year. And if you're interested in a serving leadership coaching program, I can bring that to your company. I've got brochures up here on the table. I don't have a lot of spots left for companies this year, but I could look at next year. Basically, what it is, I offer it either to an individual or to a company. And each quarter, I come in, I do some training and teaching and then coaching around those concepts of serving leadership. And there's resources involved in that. There's worksheets in which you actually apply what I'm talking about. So if you're interested, see me at the table, and we'll process that together. And then lastly, I've written a devotional on serving leadership from the Gospel of Matthew. That's a soft cover. That's only $10 here today. And if you're interested in my blog, there's also a link there on how you can subscribe to that. And I also have the old-fashioned clipboard. If you don't want to do it digitally, you can always put your email address down on that. Well, thank you so much for coming to the session this morning. I'm going to turn it back to Brian. We're going to take a break, and I'll be back this afternoon. We're going to talk about firing people and a lot more. Thank you.